Good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to the London School of Economics. My name is Ricky Burdett, and with Philip Rode, I run a research and teaching center here called LSE Cities. We're here to welcome Erion Velay, the mayor of Tirana, and Amika Dahl, who's a practicing architect here in London, who is equally interested in many of the themes that Erion is putting in practice, that is, children in the city, hence the title of this talk. Before I start, I just want to, first of all, tell you that you're the second group of people sitting in this wonderful new building by the Rogers-Firth Harbour Partnership. We've only just opened it, so you're test-driving the building, in a way, for us. The other thing to say is that this event is actually part not just of the teaching program of the Executive Masters, but it's also part of something called the Shape the World series, which is a festival that the London School of Economics is organizing, in fact, in March next year, or it comes to a culmination in March next year, and this is one of the many events that leads up to it, and the whole notion of how do you shape the world through policy, looking at issues of equity, of economy, but of course, from our point of view, of design. Now, I mentioned Amika before I introduce Erion a little bit more fully. Amika is, in fact, a director of a group called Assemble, which nearly as an architectural term says a lot about the way they work, and well known for their architecture, their art, their design practice. In fact, one of the few architectural firms that won one of the most prestigious art prizes ever a few years back. But she's here in particular because she's working on a theme that is of great interest to her and the practice, and engaged in something called the Voice of Children, which is a research project of how children actually play, what do they do in the city, and she'll show just a few slides while she talks about that. But there are also actual projects the company, the firm, is doing, including one part of London called the Baltic Street Adventure Playground, and also something a bit more intriguing to the non-architects in the room called the Brutalist Playground, which I witnessed within an institution here. So well-placed to, I think, engage with Erion's political agenda. So Erion was re-elected only a few months ago as mayor of Tirana for the second term. First term it was 2015, and before becoming mayor, he was responsible at federal government, national government, as Minister of Social Welfare and Youth. So, you know, it's not a stretch of the imagination that when he became mayor in 2015, he would take on this very personal agenda forward. And in fact, his interest goes back a long way, despite his, you know, young age, because he founded, I think, in his late teens, early 20s, a activist youth movement called MJFAFT. I'm not going to try and pronounce it in your language.
Yaft.
Right, it's that simple. Okay, fine. There we go. Which means enough, exclamation mark, enough. It was so successful as a group that after the first year, I think, of action, it was given a United Nations Award for Civil Society. I think the important thing to understand, and I think everyone no doubt will talk about it, is the context in which he's been operating. Because, you know, Tirana is a city which he inherited in 2015 after a period of really unchecked growth, after a period of very, very controlled non-growth for the previous sort of 40 or 50 years. Budgets incredibly limited in terms of welfare, in terms of the income, which could actually be contributed to major public projects. So some controversy, but certainly some debate that we should talk about, which is how do you work with the private sector, how do you find donors who will contribute to actually very strong and powerful social agendas. And just a reminder that, you know, between 1944 and 1991, Tirana was the capital of effectively what one can rightly call a completely closed country, run by an authoritarian government. And after its leader died, and there were many changes, of course, with the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the city had roughly 225,000 people in a country of 3 million people, which has actually dropped in population because so many have emigrated across Europe, in particular to Italy, the country I was brought up in, and Greece and elsewhere. So it's a question of actually trying to reconstruct the tissue, the fabric of society, and bring people back, and most importantly, investing in the next generation of those who are going to do that, which is the younger generations. So now the city has something like 800,000 people. Well, some tell me it could be a lot more than that. Depends where you actually count them. It might be something like a million people, of whom over 50,000 are younger than 6 years of age. So it gives you a sense of what level of change that that is. It's not as young as, let's say, Delhi or Lagos, but compared to Europe, much, much younger, higher proportion of young people. The country itself remains majority Muslim, so it's a country confronting many of the major changes. It's the hub for a very strong growing industry. It's a service industry city. It's part of NATO and in many ways embraced neoliberal sort of policies, which have in some cases delivered, in some cases probably not, situations that we're familiar with here. He inherited from the former mayor, I think well known, Edi Rama, to many of us here, a city that had some strong ideas but needed to be delivered. Of course, Edi Rama is now the prime minister of the country. We'll find out whether you talk to each other a lot or...
Every day.
Right, okay. And interestingly, purely from the point of view of the vision for the city, the master plan for Tirana for 2030 was actually developed by a common friend of ours, an architect from Italy called Stefano Boeri. And it's really about thinking how will the city grow between now and 2030, to perhaps a population of twice the number of what it is now. But the ideas there are very simple, very similar to many of the things here in London, making it denser, making it greener, making it more integrated, and taking even the ideas of the green belt that we have here in London and sort of double or tripling it up as a sort of a peripheral forest around the city. So Erion belongs very much to a generation of young mayors. We, in Ada Colau, for example, in Barcelona, Virginia Raggi in Rome, I would call him perhaps a sort of even more charismatic version of Enrique Pinaloza, who was re-elected 18 years after the first time. So, you know, if you get bored, you can get back then. And the agendas are not dissimilar. It's about promoting civic participation, local ownership, working with children at many different levels. And I think some of you, in particular those of you who know Erion from Albanian television, sometimes think he's too much on television. I think that's nearly one of the criticism. And your response is, that's fine. If that's the only problem, that's absolutely fine. It's good to be seen and good to be doing things. A final point to reconnect what I said at the beginning about the executive masters in cities, and delighted to see Sabas Verdes here together with Philip and others who teach in the program, is that I wanted to stress how important it is that it's a two-way learning, in the sense of the experience where people in decision-making positions are actually learning and vice versa. We learn as much. And we're delighted, Yoni, I'm going to embarrass you, because Yoni is one of the students of last year who is three quarters of the way through. He's actually the director of planning and urban design of the city. So there's an ongoing dialogue of that sort, which is very rich. Erion has become very quickly a friend of LSE, a friend of the urban age. He spoke at our conference that we organized in Addis Ababa at the end of last year. And that's why you're here today, not only because of the policies that you've enacted, but because we think there's a lot of common ground in terms of your ideas and themes we're interested in London. So can you all join me in welcoming Erion? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I be heard? Yeah? We're good? Thanks for having me. I was on my way here. I was reminded that I went to school in this country. I studied European integration at the University of Sussex. Funny enough, now it's an ideal time to study European disintegration with whatever is going on. So maybe I went to school in the wrong time in this country. But other than that, it's always to see the UK and Britain in the news. There's always stuff going on. Never a day goes without a drama. It reminds me of the Balkans. So I think the Balkanization of Britain is a very curious experiment to watch. But that's sort of my political joke for now. But how many of you, other than the Albanians in this crowd, I can see some of the faces who are Albanian, but how many of you who are non-Albanian have been to Albania? Okay, a couple, a few, yes. Well, you know, Ricky mentioned it was the North Korea of Europe. for most of the Cold War. So if you're British and you connect to Albanians, whether they're from Albania or Kosovo, you know Rita Ora and Dua Lipa, and of course Mother Teresa was Albanian. John and James Belushi, the Blues Brothers, they were also Albanian. You probably don't know the guy Farid Murat, who invented Viagra. He's also Albanian. So for a small country, our contribution to sort of the world order are fairly disproportionately positive. This is where the story begins, and I wanted to share the story of a city that is the love of my life. And again, to start with a joke, they once asked President Lyndon Johnson, and they said, "Mr. Johnson, you know, during your time in the White House and in politics, President Kennedy was assassinated, Martin Luther King was assassinated, you had protests everywhere. How did you keep your act together?" And he said, "Every time before I went to bed," he said, "I would watch myself in the mirror, I'd sort of be in front of the mirror, and I'd say, 'Lyndon, every time you have drama in your life, think it could have been worse. You could have been a mayor.'" So it also goes as a free advisory. But I'll tell you, this is the picture from my first day in office. And this was pretty much my job description. I didn't have, we had another mayor between me and Eddie Rama. And so it was an empty office, and I came out, and this is the picture that I saw. This was clearly the act of free enterprise, and a lot of the shock therapy and the Milton Friedman, you know, everybody to themselves, went from a centralized system where the political party in charge, the Communist Party, decided where you went to school, where you went to work, who you married, the type of furniture you had in your house, what type of housing space you got, to then a sense of freedom where eventually a very centralized state collapsed and the invisible enemy never showed up. Which was, when I was growing up in third grade, a mandatory book to read by Enver Hoxha was The Anglo-American Danger for Albania. So we were all grown up with this paranoia, and once the enemy never showed up, a lot of the people who were dispersed in the country, whether it was mines, or whether it was military establishments, or whether it was factories that collapsed, all rushed to the capital. And pretty much sort of this urban growth of the capital happened overnight. We went from 200,000 people to almost a million. And from a place, and this is from the other window of my office, this is what the road downtown in the roundabout looked like. During communism, no one owned anything private. Private property was by law forbidden. So the city I grew up in only had 20 cars for 200,000 people. So only the Politburo and the generals of the army had a car. And those of you who grew up in Albania are shaking your hand because you remember those days. So we went from 20 cars to 200,000 cars, who in total are doing 800,000 segments a day. 400,000 segments, so half of the trips, are less than 1 kilometer. So what you're realizing is that a car became a status symbol. So you went to Italy and you brought a Fiat, mostly to tell your neighbor that you're not a poor commie anymore. You made it, you went to Bari, you brought a Fiat back. And you're parading the Fiat around to show that you became someone in life. So it really became a trophy and a status symbol, and also became the epicenter of the city. I think public squares show what's important. So during communism, public square had the statue of Enver Hoxha in the middle. And now the public square had the monument of a car in the middle. Because apparently in capitalism, that's your new trophy, and that's your new hero of the liberal life. So this was my first day in office. I said, what do we do now? We look at the window from the third window. It's an oval office, and then the clock tower is stuck, so it only shows the time right two times a day. So 6:37 in the morning, 6:37 in the evening. So as mayor or any one of you who's involved in public, you really want to start with some symbolism. And when all the journalists are gathering together, says, you know, "Mr. Mayor, we did all these reforms in the Ministry of Labor, Pensions, Job Market. What is the big thing in the city?" I said, "The big thing, fix the damn clock tower. Because a city that is stuck on time, a good city cannot only get it right twice a day." So we started with a small thing, but it was August, so it was the middle of the heat. Everybody in the Mediterranean is on the beach. So I said, "School's open in September. Let's see what kindergartens and nurseries look like." They look like this. They look like this. They look mostly like prison cells look in this country. And then most of it were occupied with people who had built inside the schoolyard, inside the kindergarten or the nursery. And then we sort of said, we're bankrupt. We could fix the clock tower, but we can't pay for 100 nurseries and kindergartens. So let's play a game. this is the most unusual thing to say when you're bankrupt. It's like the Titanic is sinking and you say, you know, let's keep with the violin. But we had an idea. We said, why don't we start an Albanian version of the Extreme House Makeover? And you've seen that reality show when you basically get different crews who are recording everything and turning over a house, a shabby house, within 1 week, and then there's a jury that evaluates. So we invited the 100 top companies in the city. I said, look, if the city is producing 50% of the GDP, it's got to produce 50% of the philanthropy, otherwise the numbers don't match. So why don't we invite the city hall, the top 100 companies? We gave everyone a file and we said, look, you got 1 month and we will find out which bank or which telecom or which other enterprise can do the best kindergarten and nursery if you ever want to knock back on my door again for the next 4 years. So it was a bit of a blackmail in a time of complete desperation. And then it started looking like this, the same thing that I showed you before. And then it's amazing what happens when people get involved and parents get involved and companies get involved. And then mothers are coming and, you know, helping you with the drapes. Someone is coming and helping with the kitchen. Someone is planting salad in the same place where an illegal house was in the middle of the courtyard of the nursery or kindergarten. These kids are having fun. Then we went from kindergartens to schools. This is a school that we just actually opened yesterday or 2 days ago. That was done by young architects. And then we sort of had this army of kids who are now involved. With Stefano Boeri, now we're working with these 24/7 schools. But the question that everybody asks is, why kids? What's the story about starting with kids? Now, when you're a mayor or when you're a politician, you get all types of consultants and helpers and political know-it-alls. So rule number one is, in politics, you always worry about the next election. That means you really need to be nice to taxpayers and you really need to be nice to voters. But the question is, are cities only made of taxpayers and voters? Children are not taxpayers and voters. So we got a lot of heat in the very beginning when people were saying, why are you spending some time with kids? These people didn't vote for you. And if they didn't vote for you, you don't owe anything to them. This is completely counterintuitive in politics. And then we carried on with this idea. And then we said, well, look, in every family, I remember growing poor in Albania, and what I remember as a punchline from my parents was, if the two boys, I had a little brother, if the two boys have eaten, we've also eaten. I said, this doesn't make sense because you didn't eat. What do you mean? But to parents, it meant that if kids were clothed and fed and they did well, it was enough to get them feel fed and well and their aspirations fulfilled. So then we said, look, in a city of 1 million people with an average age of 30, there's got to be like 300,000 kids, right? So where are all the kids? You couldn't see them in public life. Everybody's holed with an iPhone or an iPad. Public life or public space has been occupied by the local bully who wants to put his Fiat or this Mercedes in the courtyard where kids used to play back in the old days. So we said, why don't we carry this even further? Kids need to play. I mean, we remember we connect most of our childhood with play. We didn't read encyclopedias at 3 or 4. We played. We said, why don't we build the largest playground in the Balkans for a city that has zero playgrounds and 1 million people and 300,000 kids? The first day when we started construction, a huge protest. People are literally grabbing the pillars from the construction site and beating the workers and the municipal police. Part of it was the right-wing opponents we had just defeated. Part of it was really well-meaning tree huggers, environmentalists, activists who said, no playgrounds in the park. And we say, but why? What is with this hysteria? I tell you why. When you run for office, and I see it in this country as well, the number one word you hear from any candidate is change. So people say things like, who wants change? And everybody raises their hand in the rallies, we want change. But then when you win and you have to actually govern the place, and you ask the same people, now, who wants to change? And everybody sort of looks shy and says, you know, let him change first because, you know, he's easy, I'm a bit difficult, you know me. And you understand that the concept of change is a very sexy concept when it happens to other people. But when it happens to you and it changes your routine and all of a sudden in a park that no one is using and it's really decrepit, a colorful pop-up playground will appear, you're not so fond of change as you were during the campaign. So not all people are politically motivated when they have a resistance to change. So we say, well, look, you know, these kids don't vote, but it doesn't mean they shouldn't have their share of public finance going to the city. So we said, look, you know, members of parliament show up with their guns in this protest for a playground. It became almost a Guinness Book of Records type of story, because in 100 days we had 78 violent protests. But we said, look, we're not going to blink. If we're truly committed to this cause, then we're going to stick to the end and let the opening day be the referendum. It looked like this. And it looks like this every day. And then, because we were so inspired from this story, and it became sort of a metaphor of how hard it is to inject change, then we started doing more. And then we went from sort of major playgrounds to these community playgrounds, like little pieces of acupuncture. In places like southern Italy or Greece or Albania and the Mediterranean in general, it's not only the kid who goes to play. It's also the grandparents, the grannies who need to catch up with the gossip. It's also the granddads who, you know, need to catch up with domino and chess. So it's a family affair. And it's what Jane Jacobs used to say, eyes on the street. We didn't add more police, but we have less crime, simply because in certain areas of the city that were completely run down, it's full of life. And these kids in long Mediterranean summers are playing until late, until they exhaust themselves to sleep. And then we find out that these eyes on the street are materializing everywhere, and they become sort of these community affairs. And this is a bit of the acupuncture we do in all this. We find a pocket, we clear it from somebody's Fiat garage, and then this pop up. But the question is, it's great, it's symbolic, but does it really change a city other than these pieces of acupuncture? So we go back to the story of how to cross the street from my office on the first day. And then we ran this focus group, and I'm happy Amika is here, because she does sort of what we do as intuitive work, she measures it. So we asked people in this focus group, we said, what is the most important thing in your life? Everybody the same answer, as probably everybody would answer here, my children, my family. And in the Balkans or southern Italy or Greece, everybody has these great metaphors, they are the light of my eye, blah, blah, blah. So they carry on with this poetry about how important kids are. And we said, great answer. So if kids are the most important thing in your life, would you agree that you spend most of your income on your child? Mr. Mayor, why do you offend me? Of course I do. You said, well, should we make a little calculation? Which we did. And we found out that the average Tirana family was spending 32% of the income on the car and only 20% on one child. Which meant that by buying the car or paying installments, parking the car, taking the car to the mechanic, fueling the car, insuring the car, you spend more than raising a child. Food, clothing, education, toys, whatnot. People were scandalized because they felt betrayed. They felt someone had changed their values without asking their permission. And everybody was blushing when we did this focus groups. So we said, if kids are important, maybe we should ask kids what we do with some of the parts of our city. So then we said, why don't we organize a car-free day? Let's not talk about it. You know, we decided next Sunday or next whatever Saturday was, it's a car-free day in all of the downtown area. In the morning, as you can imagine, it was a PR disaster. The F word about the mayor appeared in everybody's Facebook status. But things, and you know, our communications office, you know, my colleagues are here, they went berserk. They said, Mr. Mayor, this is the stupidest thing we've ever done. We're completely lost. But it started to change in the evening, because kids went home. So when the parents were still giving me the F word and the city administration, because they had to go around the downtown area, kids started to intervene as we were doing all these interviews later on how this change happened. And they were like, Dad, yeah, maybe, maybe. But you remember the bike you bought me 3 years ago? I never got to use it until now that there is a space downtown without cars where I can rollerblade and take my scooter and have my hoverboard and ride a bike. So we said, well, look, we're making some advancement. What if we do it every month? And then what if we do it every week? And then what if we do it full weekends? So not just one day, but Saturday and Sunday. And then what if we do sports? And then we said, what if we do it permanent? And kids, for 1 year, you know, I've seen probably every person is suspicious of politicians, but no one is suspicious of their own child. So we were able to communicate one great project that we've had in the shelf for a long time only by the power of kids going to every household and communicating this change. And finally realigning our values with our spending or our values with our decision making. Last year, 2018, in Barcelona, we won the prize for the best public space in Europe for 2018. And then we started asking ourselves on how we can introduce greenery in the cities. You know, cities are mostly associated with asphalt and concrete and cement. So we work with the likes of Stefano Boeri with the idea of urban forests. So we ran the largest urban transplantation. You know, it's like you transplant your kidney. We transplanted literally a forest in what was formerly the largest roundabout in Europe. And instead of having roughly 120,000 cars go around and turn it into a cancer spin, we turn it into the largest urban park in the heart of the city and the largest pedestrian space in Eastern Europe. And it looks, for those of you who visit, it looks like this every evening for the last 2 years. Water features are always fun in hot Mediterranean. Then we started to go a bit further. And we said, but what do we associate the Mediterraneans mostly with? Great food, right? When you think Italy, you think mozzarella, you think pizza, you think pasta. When you go to Greece, you think feta, and you think tzatziki, and all the fish. And Albania, that is sandwiched between the two, is big on food. It's the only place you don't go for a diet. You know, you're lost. Find a diet somewhere else, but it won't work there. But food is such a central part of the Mediterranean psyche. And when I was a little kid, because of a family story of having lost my father, I used to sell dry figs in this market in downtown Tirana. So we said, look, places of food are also places of community. So playgrounds, eating areas, markets. And we said, you know, I went back to the market where I used to sell and it looked like this. It's right downtown Tirana. So when we had the idea to change it, again, resistance. So everybody wants change, but not in my turf. You change yourself, not me. And I said, well, why not? Well, it's national heritage. It's been like this since the time of the Ottoman Empire. I said, what exactly is national heritage? Rats? Mud? Dirt? Dust? Asbestos? This cannot be national heritage. So sometimes people under this nostalgia of protecting the past go to the extremes of not wanting to accept any change to the present. And then, so it looked like this on the last day, and then after 7 months, it started looking like this. And people, this is the same people selling, but they have more dignity. They have more passion. They can't wait to go up to work in a clean place, in the most Instagrammable place in Tirana. So then this idea not only of playgrounds, but in markets. So basically we were targeting places where people show up for life. And cities are places in general where we show up for life. Now we go to escape in a village, but we come to protest in a city, we join a party in the city, we go to a university in the city. Most of public life, most of showing up for life happens in a city. So we carried on with some of this transition in other parts. And then kids are an endemic species. They're like, literally. So if kids show up, it's a confirmation, you know, it's like with bike lanes. Bike lanes, if you see women in the Balkans, I'm talking about, women biking alone at 3 a.m., it's a sign of safety. Macho men you can see at all times of the day. But when you see in the Balkans this typology, so this endemic species, then you understand that there's a survival opportunity for the species that otherwise were leaving the public realm. I am probably saying a lot of politically incorrect stuff, but you know what I mean. And then they become, you know, it's a food market during the day, but it's a party scene during the night. And you've seen this a lot in plazas in Italy and Greece and the Mediterranean. But no one expected to see this in the North Korea of Europe. And then we went to the issue of equity. And I know there's a lot of designers here. So in the same focus group, we were asking, if Tirana has 1 million people and 200,000 drivers, that means only 20% of the people have a car, right? So the question is, if only 20% of the people own a car, why do they use 90% of public space? Because roads are public space. So if the property tax, at least in my city, is equal for everyone, we just pay a small flat fee, which means it's equal for bikers, for bus riders, and for walkers, why are 20% of the people getting 90% of the public space? So we invited Grimshaw Architects out of London. And we said, look, what it would be like in a dream situation if we're building a new boulevard, the width of the Champs-Élysées, 70 meters. What it would be like if we designed with this democratic proportion based on taxpayer contribution and user experience rather than the guys who have the big metal boxes. So we took this and turned it into experiment, this design project, knocked down all the old stuff that was there, and when we opened up, it was like this. So from a deserted place, when you see no one, to a place that is swarming with life, simply because we designed in a democratic way. And I think design is very important, and architects are very important. I think the revolution that Stefano Boeri started with urban forests, or what we're doing with Grimshaw, basically proves the point from that famous movie, Field of Dreams, when they build a baseball diamond. They say, build it and they will come. But if you build it fairly, then you will get people proportionally based on the fairness and the equity of users in the city. And instead of having a boulevard for cars, it's basically become the largest linear park for citizens who come to see public space now treated completely differently from the superiority that cars used to have before. And we're going on with new projects. But then we started this idea. You've heard it. You know, today was big news everywhere. Milan is planting 3 million trees in something called the orbital forest. So we started this 3 years ago. The question for a poor city is, where do you find the money? Trees are expensive. And you don't want to buy tiny trees that, you know, goats can eat. You want to buy a big tree that immediately gives shade and looks pretty. And that costs money. So we said, what if these kids that were energized from these pedestrian spaces and from these playgrounds, what if they could play a role that parents couldn't do? So we would ask parents, I'd ask my friends, and I'd say, Arian, we love you to death, but what is this, like communism? Me volunteering? Volunteer is almost like a dirty word, like a contagious disease. I'm not a commie anymore. Rightly so, because, you know, back in communism, to be a volunteer meant to be slave labor. You go do railways. You don't do railways with volunteers, you do them with engineers. So people have almost an allergy towards the word, but kids don't. Kids don't have dogma, they don't have a voting record, they don't have party membership. So for all those reasons, if kids like something, they do it. So we sort of said, what if we start the greatest game, just like we did Extreme House Makeover? What if every child planted a tree for their birthday? And what if we get a success rate of 50%? So instead of 300,000 kids, we get at least half to do this. Actually, we got a lot more than that. We got 200,000 kids in each of the years to plant trees for their birthday. We call them birthday trees. So they have an app, APR Tirana, which is our parks and recreation. They find the type of tree that the family can afford. Some are $5, 5 euros, or 5 pounds. Some are 50 or 100. They know exactly where the tree is. We will open the hole for them with this worker. So they go and make them all ready. And then the kids will show up on their birthday, put the thing in the hole, come in the summer during the drought, bring their little water bottle to water. When they have guests, they come in and you know, introduce them. You know, hello, this is my tree. Tree, meet my cousin. Whatever fun things you can think about. But we have noticed one thing. Have you noticed that you don't throw trash in your own house? You don't piss in your own house? You don't spit in your own house? You know why? Because you belong there, and the house belongs to you. But you do this in places where you don't belong. And where people are vandalizing and spraying and pissing in the street and spitting and vomiting, it's because a great majority don't feel they belong there. They think they are passers-by. They think they live in a dormitory, not in a city, in an agora. So we found out that putting roots should not only be a metaphor. It should be a physical experience. And this act of planting trees turned way, you know, bigger than Stefano Boeri's putting green stuff in the city. It turned out into turning a metaphor of putting roots into a physical experience. One child that plants a tree definitely will never cut one and definitely won't do any of the vandalist stuff that I mentioned before. And we found out that it's easier to clean the city and it's easier to maintain stuff once kids are involved in such an experience. And it goes on and on and on and on. We have thousands of pictures. When the mayor finds 1 hour, he squeezes to one of the tree planting sessions. So we group birthdays, as you notice. Now, we are not Holland is one of the most popular things that I've heard when it comes to bike lanes. So you sort of say, yeah, I know. Holland was not Holland 50 years ago. If you look at old pictures of Amsterdam, you can see this sort of the car choked. And we know the history. Europe came and America came after First and Second World War. So you had all these factories that are building planes and tanks, and all of a sudden thousands of people may lose their jobs because the war is over. So we got a lot of political involvement. If you see the ads in Europe and the ads in the United States, in the 50s and the 60s, everybody was encouraged to get cars so we could keep people employed and politicians keep getting voted. But then it collapsed our cities. So the question is, why do we build cities? We build cities for cars or we build cities for people? I think we build cities for people. That should be the answer. So we said, look, why don't we start again with kids as a catalyst for change? We started making it mandatory that kids as young as three, part of their kindergarten experience is to learn how to bike. And I know it's not going to... If you come to Tirana, you'll probably say, it's still not Holland. Yes, but it's at least triple the number of people who are now biking because it's safe, because it's protected, and because it starts with children. Once one of these kids wants to go out and bike after they do their course, then the whole family needs to buy bikes because they need to chase after the little one. And you find out that some of the most overlooked characters in our society, children, non-voters, non-taxpayers, can be movers and shakers in a way that no politics, no PR, no marketing, no lobbying firm can ever do. So then we started doing these beautiful alleys, when, you know, decorated with trees, and then you get the police involved, and then they do bike sharing, the same bike sharing that we do here. So we started with this bike sharing. My argument is, and our argument in the administration was, that the only advantage to being disadvantaged like us, to being sort of the last arrivals in the scene after communism, is that you can immediately leapfrog. So even if you leave, you know, I know you have some students from Africa, some students from Latin America. Some of this stuff we've learned from Bogota, from Medellin. We've looked at some of the urban change. You know, Mobike is a Chinese company. I know there's a few Chinese students here. So people say, yeah, but in China, you know that song, there are 9 million bicycles in Beijing, they're used to bicycles. And you know, in Amsterdam, and these Albanians, they will steal the bikes. Yeah, we have some vandalism and some theft, but we're way better than Manchester. In Manchester, they stole 60% of the bikes. The company went bankrupt in a week. So let's not be so rough on ourselves. You know, for non-EU, poor country, developing country, I have EBRD friends here, we're helping with some of this project, they consider us sort of low income, we steal less bikes than folks in Manchester. So sometimes we sort of have this sense of prejudice that certain things don't work in certain societies because it's cultural, but it doesn't hurt to try. So many people spend so much time brainstorming. My advice is they spend more time try-storming. And then if something doesn't work, you try something else. But you can brainstorm yourself to death without, you know, making a decision. I was joking with Ricky. I remember when I was a student here, they were brainstorming about turning Oxford Street pedestrian. 4 mayors later, they're still brainstorming about it. You know? Eventually, they just have to try and see if it works or if it fails. But jokes aside, leapfrogging to what is the latest technology. So rather than being like Paris, where it took 16 years to do a procurement for bikes that the city owns, the private sector has already overpassed you and does them for really cheap in China, and it doesn't matter if 30% gets stolen, still breaks even and makes life easier in the city. So tri-storming is something we take very dearly. Electric buses, when I became mayor 5 years ago, they were €500,000 apiece. In my second mandate, they are €250,000 apiece. So if an Iveco in Italy, a diesel bus, would be 300,000, this is still cheaper. So also keep up with technology. Things are changing all the time, even cities that couldn't afford stuff. So now electrical buses, Santiago in Chile, it's all going electrical. Actually, we are a bit behind because they ordered all the buses that were already ready in Beijing. So even poor cities now can afford technology that otherwise they couldn't afford before. And the same thing with taxes. And we said, look, you know, we don't own Teslas, we cannot afford the Tesla. Yeah, but this is a trick. In the city of London, or in the city of New York, or Tirana, or Paris, the number of taxis is fixed. Usually it's one per 10,000 inhabitants. They're called medallions or licenses. And we're poor, we can't subsidize electric vehicles, but we said this. If you come with a diesel car, you will wait in line. It might be 5-7 years until one medallion is freed. This is how it works in New York and London. But if you come with electric, we will give you a license in 24 hours. In 1 year, just by changing the rules and being a bit lax more relaxed about licenses when it came to electric vehicles. Half of the fleet of the taxis of Tirana are electric, and who's been there recently has seen this. So sometimes being a smart city is not necessarily covering your poles with gadgets and sensors and cameras. Sometimes it's about smart thinking. And this issue of trees, I'll tell you one last joke, and then I'll invite my good friend to share, and then we can have questions later. I was in one of these events at the UN, and when you're a mayor, you are the preferred target from all these predators that produce these smart city gadgets. So you come out of the event, and they say, "Oh, Mr. Mayor, we love what you do, and we have a product that will really work for you." And I said, "Yeah, great. What product?" So they show me this panel. It's like one of these roll-ups. And it says, you know, it has this green fungus, and it has got these chips, and it operates like a vacuum cleaner. You plug it, it sucks up the air, which is dirty, you know, filters the carbon, produces the clean air, and it will cost you 250,000 euros. And I said, "You gotta be kidding me. I don't know what you call this in Germany. But in Albania, the thing that takes carbon and produces oxygen, we call it a tree. It's much cheaper." So my advice to a lot of you who are doing this stuff, and I'm going to stop here because I could go on forever, is, never let sort of this hysteria about gadgets and smart city take over common sense. And some stuff that is really basic, human wisdom should always prevail beyond, this is not the Friday after Thanksgiving when everybody goes on a Black Friday and runs their credit card dry. I think shopping for your city should be a way where common sense prevails over covering the city with gadgets. And this is some other stuff we're doing with young people, and this is the controversial debate for the theater, which has already seen a lot of protests, but I'm willing to talk that during the Q&A, because I think this is a never-ending conversation. And once you are engaged in constant change, then you get, constant...
Give us a summary. What's the...
So here's the issue. This is an old theater that was built during the fascist period, during the time where Mussolini commissioned a lot of public works in Tirana. Some are the solid government buildings, but some were temporary dopo lavoro, sort of after work entertainment for the military barracks that were based in Tirana, so the fascist military. Now, it was meant for 7 years. It's done with panels of alga made out of leftover matches from a Milan, the Pater company, from a Milan factory that produced matches. So they came up with this alga glue, and all the leftover from the matches in the factory, that glue them in these panels, sent them in a ship so they could quickly build theaters and cinemas. It was originally a cinema. Now, nostalgia is an important factor. People have nostalgia. I'm sure there were people nostalgic about the building that was here previously. I'm happy we're the second group to be here, and I'm sure there was a debate about it. So we're going through a very interesting debate, and then we have a proposal from Bjarke Ingels, from the BIG group. We think it's an iconic building. We understand in the Balkans, in Italy happens the same way, in Greece, and things get overly politicized. Everybody becomes a master of everything. So we're currently having a debate whether to knock down the old theater, which has clearly outdone its life. It was meant for 7 years. Now it's almost 88 years. And how do we use the private sector? Because that's also controversial. And I agree. If we were a rich place, we'd pay for everything. But we couldn't pay for the nurseries and kindergartens in a month. We couldn't pay for this beautiful stadium that is actually just about to be opened up. So we had to cut a deal with Marriott to do a hotel tower. And then we get a brand new stadium from Marco Casamonti, another Italian. He did the stadium in Udine and a few other projects. So when you're in this line of work, you have to make decisions constantly. And you don't always keep everyone happy. But I think it's important to have a debate and in the end have the majority make a decision and move on. And I think the pace where the city is moving, we've seen a huge growth in tourism. And I think people are being fascinated on how a culture that revered kids as so important within the family structure, but completely left them out in public life, is now finally coming to terms and making kids epicenter of public life. So thank you very much. You were so kind to have me here. And then I'll be happy to take some questions.
Well, there are another 700 slides afterwards.
No, it's five more.
I think as we load up. I'm just interested to know, carry on, whether when you started, let's call this focus on the non-voting generation, were there models? Were there other cities?
There's a few organizations out there that are doing fantastic work. So we actually came to meet and find out after we started with these experiments. So one great group that I was sharing with Amrika, it's a foundation in Amsterdam called the Bernard Van Leer Foundation. So they started this global initiative called Urban 95. Why 95? Because 95 centimeters is the height of a three-year-old child. So the question to designers and to architects was, what would a city look like if we were 95 centimeters? Could you cross the street safely? Can cars see you? If you're driving an SUV, can you be seen? Is the pavement walkable? Are school surroundings and nurseries and kindergartens safe for you to go pretty much on your own if the parent drops you at the beginning of the street? So there's a few initiatives out there that are doing fantastic work. This is just one of them.
The chief executive of the foundation I've just mentioned is another student on the...
Cecilia, yeah.
Amrika.
Small world.
If you connect, I think, this point of the Urban 95 with the work that you've been doing.
I will try my best. So thank you, first of all. It's really extraordinary to see you present the work and see some of the really amazing images of it as well.
Can you hear Amrika?
Can you hear me? Yeah? Okay, great. The thing that I really wanted to respond to, having looked at the work that you've been doing in Tirana, is I think one of the reasons that the images that you're showing are so compelling is not just because the buildings are and the parkways are kind of beautiful and really well composed, but because of the way that they're making culture and the way they're making particular ways of relating to each other and to the city itself possible. And I think that's actually where our interest in working with children started, in thinking about what kind of environments enable people to have a more active and more collective relationship with the city and with the spaces within it. And we actually started working with children because we'd spent quite a long time working with communities of adults in cities, particularly in the suburbs of post-industrial cities, communities that were quite marginalised, that were quite challenged, that were quite pushed outside of mainstream economies. And we were always being put in a position where we were being asked to pick those adults up and work with them and grow with them the possibility for change and for some kind of ground-up movement that would enable people to gradually change the conditions of their lives. And I think in order to enable change, you have to believe that the world might be other than it is, that it might be possible for things to be different. And actually, for most people who've grown up in cities as children, the built environment has told them exactly the opposite. It's actually told them, this place isn't really for you. You can't really do what you naturally do, which is play here. You're allowed to move through quite quickly. But that's about it, really. And there's a concept from primary education that we're really interested in called the hidden curriculum. And the idea is that in formal education context, there's the kind of explicit curriculum, which is things like arithmetics and geography and geology. But there's a hidden curriculum, which is the implicit things that schools teach you about how to behave, how you relate to the world, how you relate to knowledge, how you relate to collective cultures. And I think the thing which I find really extraordinary about some of your projects, but that has also driven some of ours, is the idea that the built environment also has a hidden curriculum. Mm. And it's actually teaching children that they're not really all that welcome, they're not really all that included. Often children have very limited mobility. Not only do they not vote and not pay tax, they also don't usually have any money of their own. And actually, generally, the more marginalised the communities they come from, the more that effect is exacerbated because they don't necessarily have caregivers around them who can take them around. So, in a sense, the more marginalised you already are, the more you're in an environment which holds you in that state. And it's really particularly acute for children because children are also self-forming through the environment. So children's play is them developing a sense of themselves in the world in dynamic relationships with the environment. And lots of children's environments are actually very static. Even ones which are deliberately for children, they really prescribe the behaviour quite closely, like you can swing, you can climb, you can maybe jump, but that's it. And I think some of the things that are really wonderful about these kind of public spaces, which you've started to show us, is actually that they are more open and they're more permissive, and they understand children as part of the world and part of the environment. I once was watching a video relay of a conference about children in the city, and someone stood up and said that they thought we had a lot to celebrate because we were the only species on Earth who made special places for our young to play and be safe, right? Which, if you think about it, is just the most absurd idea, because actually we're the only species that have consistently made most of our environment totally uninhabitable and unsuitable for our young. So I think the thing that's super interesting is this idea of really putting children's habitability, children's safety, children's capacity to play right at the heart of the idea about what the city is and what it should be. And then instead of coming to this position where we're then wondering how do we re-engage these adults in political processes and local councils, in planning debates, how do we re-engage them in national politics, what we say is we start at the beginning and we say, how does the way you relate to the environment substantially create your sense of how you relate to the world around you, how you relate to each other, what kind of right you have to be who you are, and to act in ways which your instinct and your evolution is telling you to. So I'm just going to quickly tell you what these videos are. These videos, two of them are from Tokyo, one is from Yokohama, and one is from Granada. And they're all environments where children are supported to act in a really meaningful and sustained way on each other and on their environment. So they're all public spaces, particularly the two in Tokyo, they're not fenced, but they're places where adults have asked themselves, what do children want and need to do naturally to grow and to develop and to find their place in the world and find a place where they feel safe and grounded and active, and then what can we do to protect that? And that's radically different to the small fenced playground, and it's coming much closer to this idea of actually, why is the city centre for cars when cars kill children? Why do we spend so much more money on playgrounds than on traffic calming measures outside schools, for example, in this country? And I think these environments really start to talk about what it looks like when you prioritise occupation and social activity over the capacity to move through, which is ultimately what most 95%, but also even the ones that aren't roads, public spaces in Europe enable.
You were about to make a comment, then I'd like to.
No, I thought this was brilliant, and you can tell someone who studies this and someone who makes this stuff up as they go. So you basically found words to some of the stuff I couldn't probably describe, but one thing that impressed me is that we forget to quantify some of the stuff that has become our routine. So, you know, we were at the embassy, and one of the embassy employees says, Mr. Mayor, we've done great work, but if we could just make the roads a bit wider. No, but so to someone stuck in traffic, it's almost intuitive. So if roads were bigger, we'd go faster. So maybe someone should just invite the mayor of Houston in L.A., they have 16 lanes on each side of that, and traffic goes on for miles. So, you know, we need to figure out on how academia can help us communicate what's induced demand. So basically, the more lanes you have, the more invitation you have for cars to show up. And then we sort of forget that a car is idle 95% of the time. Think of your car. It's probably moved only 5% of the maximum of the last 24 hours. The rest, it has just occupied a space somewhere, which is, especially in this town, a very expensive piece of real estate.
But in what Amika is showing us with these images, but probably more significantly, just this methodology of observation, surveying, which then informs designing, informs thinking, basically informs the brief. That's a critical thing. It's probably something which would be quite useful to you as mayor, right?
But when you mentioned that this unique species, we forget that for the last 2 million years, we have walked and ran. It's only been the last 100 years that we sit in a box like this. So a lot of it is about going back to our inherent nature. So, you know, fish swim, birds fly, and humans, for the majority of their presence in this planet, walk and run. So this is not our state of nature, to sit in a box and do this. So that's why I really appreciated that.
I think one of the things, Amika, you said, whether you actually said those words, I picked it up as meaning that, that effectively the built environment becomes a curriculum. I mean, it's a lesson in and of itself. I think an incredibly powerful notion that, you know, things are designed and the lessons are learned or not, or they're a statement of a sort of an ideology, right? I think that's, I want to park that there because I think that's a new way of talking about what legacy a mayor leaves, right, in terms of future generations. But another thing that just strikes me, we're looking at these images, and I think everyone, I can just see you're all connecting somehow with what you're seeing there. There's something about a movement of children, wherever they happen to be in the world, and it's very global, which you connect with. It reminded me of a film that was done in the 1970s by a sociologist called Holly White. He was someone who worked at the time for Jane Jacobs and others. And actually was the film of the movement of just people in one of then New York's very new public open spaces. And it was very, very simple. It was just shown how resilient human beings are. They don't crash into each other. They go and sit where the sun is there. They like being quite close to each other, but not as close as Italians and Albanians, right, because and all that. But it was a study that
intimate.
The physical form sustains completely different behaviors. Right? And I think, Amika, I was wondering whether, in the end, what you're telling us that the playground is one thing, but there are lessons to be learned about designing public space outside it. So say more about that, and how do you put that in practice?
I think one way, I guess, the kind of scale that you're talking about working at is to say that you have a struggle, right, when you try and take away road space, because it's like, of course, the priority is the car. And that's just to do with habit and what we've got used to, right? So what seems like natural and obvious, and then we take for granted and we find it very hard to change. And I think in lots of cities that we work in, particularly in the north of the UK, the public space, for example, but also the housing stock, also the built facilities are badly maintained, they're ugly, they're dirty, and they say things to the people that occupy them every day. Mm-hmm. And they actually say, you're not really part of this wider collective, which is the city. Mm-hmm. We don't really worry about you that much. You can take care of yourself. And actually, I think that has a very serious impact in terms of then how you start to build a culture of people, an engaged culture of people who are active in their city and who, you know, become the people that you hope will be able to create the robust culture that can then keep your work going, right? So it's this question of like how or if it's possible working in the environment and through design to start to create different messages about what's possible, but also create different opportunities to make them real, make it not just a look, and make people feel cared for, right? Because feeling cared for by the environment, I think, is part of feeling part of a larger collective and starting to feel part of a network of mutual responsibility. So it's not just about whether it works, it's about whether it talks to you, what its social role is. And I think actually there is in that a few links down the chain, a very real political reality about then how engaged people feel in these broader processes and systems of representation.
One thing I've found out is that it's almost always important in a debate to recognize it. So if you're part of a debate, what constitutes a loud minority? That will always, you know, there's this great now series about Fox News called The Loudest Voice. So sometimes the loudest voice is not necessarily the majority. And the loudest voice doesn't mean they're absolutely right. So I think being able to recognize that if you're a decision maker is paramount. If you were to survey, and we've done a few of this, to survey drivers, 80% of the drivers normally in these mock surveys or funny surveys will sincerely claim that parking is a Geneva Convention human right. Literally, I mean, because habits then starts builds this dogma, then you start believing something that it's complete fiction. It's not a human right. It's not part of the human right charter. So to demand parking to mayors or councils or city officials, as if you were demanding, you know, education or vaccines, or is completely an act of fiction. Mm-hmm. Parking is the act of renting someone's space, private or public, with a fee, just like you rent. You know, I joke sometimes with people and I said, Mr. Mayor, I have a car now, but I don't know where to park it. And, you know, now we don't have parking because of these bike lanes. And I said, do you have a refrigerator at home or a washing machine? Yeah, of course. When you went to buy a washing machine, did you just sort of randomly walk and bought a washing machine and then went home and said, geez, where am I going to put this? So if every other toy in your life or tool in your life, you've already thought before, where are you going to put it? How come that for buying these 3 tons of metal with wheels, you think this is the job of the public sector to worry about? Mm-hmm. So I said, just like you worry about you're going to put your washing machine and your dishwasher, please think before you get a car, where are you going to put it and whether it's worth it, whether it pays off. And for cities in Italy, Albania, Mediterranean, with 300 days of sunshine, of mostly flat spaces, it really is a no-brainer that the car is an expensive toy to have and for most people unaffordable.
I think the really critical thing from the point of view of a designer, but I think also from a kind of policy point of view, is that there's a big difference between taking people into account and asking them what you should do, right? And we always call this like the flexible meeting room problem, which is like almost any community
that we get... Flexible what?
Meeting room problem.
Right.
Like almost any community that we go to work in, you get this repeated thing of a lot of people always asking you for this kind of ideal, flexible space where all these interesting social events can happen. And really what they're asking for is interesting social events, right? And so there's a question around how you establish needs and how you make design decisions which understand and are empathetic towards people but aren't asking them to become designers or become policymakers. And I think this thing around parking is just a really cute example of that. But it actually, I think, amplifies out to all kinds of decisions. And I think often that's why participatory design processes get a bad name. And they probably should be, because it's actually very patronizing to ask someone who already has a complex role in the world to also become an amateur architect for a half an hour of your consultation. So I think if you put these kinds of decisions through the lens of the parking car, then you can start to, I hope, develop a slightly more nuanced way of thinking about how you could be...
Well, I don't know how many parking spaces there are in Tirana, but would you have the courage to stop parking in the city centre and go for re-election?
I already did this once.
Do what Ken Livingston did here... Now, 2004.
Congestion charge. Or
the congestion charge, when all his advisors said, don't do it because it will never going to be too difficult to do, all the shops go bankrupt. And he said, look, I'm going to do it and then we'll see whether people vote for me. And they did. So I'm connecting to your point as whose voice is being heard and when, and someone needs to make a decision to try it out.
Yeah. Well, so the heart of the city is now completely car-free. So we have a couple of spots in sort of as you enter the city center where you can sort of leave your car, but then the rest is bike or walk, the administrative downtown area. Now, I think because it's an administrative center for the country, and because we're not a rich country that can afford the metro, which now the current rates of a metro are £300 million per mile. So this would mean 3 years the budget of the city of Tirana for just one station. So it's stuff that expensive, you know, the rich countries can afford. So because it's the epicenter of a country, economic, arts, culture, political, people come for either court cases or hospitals or other situations. I mean, you can't sort of go dictatorial on this. But I think having a sense of measurement with things have a human proportions to these public investments, I think that makes more sense.
I mean, it was Enrique Peñalosa, the mayor of Bogota, who I mentioned earlier, who does talk about, you know, whose right is it? Right to the city is fundamental, a right to equity, and I think that's what you're both talking about. Let's have a few questions from the floor.
Hi, my name is Lior, I'm from Israel. I want to ask you about what economic development measures are you taking in your city to enlarge your income so you can be able to make more larger projects?
You're also a mayor, did you say that?
Me, myself?
No, his name is Lior.
I'm an advisor to the mayor.
Advisor, that's pretty good, yeah. So he wants advice.
Yeah.
Let's have two more questions. Right.
Congratulations, Mr. Mayor, and for what you did for your city. I'm from China. I think that you know, in the past, we had quite a special relation. When we are very poor, we try our best to build your city. My question is that how the people in your city see China? What do you think of the past relation we had? Thank you very much.
Political question.
And just behind you.
Adrian Vos, European Network for Child-Friendly Cities. You spoke with a lot of passion and a good deal of common sense, and it sounded almost as though you had these fantastic ideas and you just made them happen. I'm sure it wasn't quite as simple as that.
No.
What I wanted to ask you is, well, two or three things really. To what extent did the national government either support what you were doing in Tirana or get in the way of your vision? To what extent was there a master plan or overarching policy, and how difficult was it to have that enacted within the city authority, and where did the money come from?
There's a code, I think, and you know, asking a question in Britain at the moment that you can combine passion with common sense. I think we are, so that's a code there, and that's, we've forgotten how to do that. Anyway, start with any of those three.
So to your colleague from Israel, and we work actually with Tel Aviv, we're part of the Urban 95 program for kids, and we work with Yona from the city of Haifa, former mayor, and Nir Barkat from Jerusalem. So Mediterranean, you know, there's similar mentalities. So some of the traits are, there's no secret, I'm a socialist. So I come from a center-left party. I know you have some socialists here at the Labour Party. It's not quite the same thing, where I'm not a Leninist, but I do believe in progressive taxation. What we found out in the city is that in the beginning that people who were large developers were not paying their fair share. And the city was covered with holes of unfinished building because tax was so low for the rich that they didn't mind taking over a dozen projects and never finishing them. So we took a very unpopular move. I increased tax for developers tenfold in the day number one. They took us to Constitutional Court, and I said, well, wait a minute. A granny that never leaves her house, or at least the playground or the courtyard of her apartment block, doesn't use the streets and the highways and the pavements, as these guys who run these concrete and cement trucks every day for their developments. They need to pay their fair share. Now, I get a lot of the heat from the extreme left who says, oh, we can't have these towers, blah, 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 as if we're all going to live under bridges. You know, the sense, not in my backyard, usually is more loud from people who are recent arrivals themselves, because they always worry about those who come next. You know, in Italy, some of the people who are most worried about new immigrants are Albanians who were the previous immigrants, you know? And the moment they are well off, they worry that the guy who's coming next is going to take their... So it's human nature, that I understand. But we made a bold decision. We said, yes, the city will be developed. You know, for me to come and talk here, of course I'm going to stay to a hotel downtown to have an easy time reaching this venue. So cities will grow, but those who make these profits will definitely have to pay more. So that was number one. Second, in a lot of our cultures... And again, I say Mediterranean, where we're a bit loose, with, you know, too much sun, not necessarily great lovers of hard work, everybody busy sipping cappuccino. People don't mind paying if everybody pays. But if you are, you know, but you're from Likud and I'm from Labour, so you don't pay, he pays, that really ticks people off. So once everybody pays, and once people see immediate results, sort of the low-hanging fruit, like a lot of this acupuncture, then people don't mind paying. And third, make it easy for people to pay. So we found out that on our first day, 7% of the people were paying property tax. So then we ran a very little gimmick, a tweak. We said, what if instead of sending two bills, or three bills, or four bills, one for cleaning, one for property tax, what if everything is in the water bill? And people pay it, everything when they go and pay for water. So within a month, it went from 7 to 97%. And so sometimes finding creative ways to collect and not turn it into an episode of The Hunger Games for people to pay tax also helps. On the second question of the special relationship with China, so a month from today we will be hosting China Plus 17, which is, but it's the mayor's program. So 1 year is the government, central government, one, so all the 70 mayors from Central Eastern Europe of the capitals will be coming to Tirana. You know, the joke was that during the communist days, a Hollywood blockbuster, by definition, is a film that has sold 100 million tickets on the box the first weekend of showing. You know, an Albanian film was shown in China and 500 million people saw it. So, you know, we really had a blockbuster program of this propaganda and social realism productions from our Kino studio that really was five times the viewership of an American Hollywood blockbuster. So I think my parents' generation has this affection. I'm afraid we're losing it. Our generation is losing it. So I think the Road and Belt project of bringing countries that may have had special relationships in the past but somehow dissipated in the recent years is a good program. And I think when it comes to smart cities and a lot of the innovation, like, you know, I say one of the reasons buses are cheaper in China is that China had battery companies that specialize in making long-standing batteries and put wheels on them, on the batteries, and call them buses. Europe has buses and tries to fill the bus boxes with batteries. And that's why I think China, just because the philosophy of designing electric transport started from the battery with the wheels, is making headways. Yes, we did have a master plan. So some was intuition, but some really was a well-discussed, and hearings and public debates and participatory sessions with the master plan, with Stefano. And I think we build on some legacy of Italian architecture during the period of fascism. One of the reasons I really wanted to go to Addis Ababa is that at some point, Albania, Libya, Eritrea, and Ethiopia were all part of the Italian crown. So for 5 years, we were co-nationals with the Ethiopians and the Libyans. And things changed later, as you know.
It did not last long. Third point about federal government.
So with the federal government, there's a few acts that we've started piloting locally. So we were the first to ban plastic bags, or actually, to be correct, put a charge on the plastic bags. And then we got the national government to support it. But there are still debates with national government where there's still stuff. For example, environmental permits type C, which means the decibels of a club, or the pollution of a kebab house, or the type of oil that a car mechanic can, is still run by the central government. So after 5 years, I still haven't won that fight. So you are absolutely right. It was rosy because time was short, but if we had a long winter night, to tell you, almost everything went with the fights, even as innocent things like planting trees with a big political fight and nonsense. So a dose of perpetual optimism is also necessary.
At the end, there was the last part of the question was, where does the money come from?
Well,
I mean, that's
kind of here's my last 2 cents on that. Depend on how you see the money. We try to see the money that we raise as yeast, not as dough. If you see it as yeast, you only put a little portion and you try to get others to help. So we said we're going to fix a park, but we're going to get a community to adopt it and then keep maintaining it. If you treat your money as dough, it runs away immediately. So we always pitch in first to get others to contribute.
I think we may want to go later to where does the private sector actually come in terms of
sure.
funding, because I think that's important. So a question here at the front.
Hello. The mayor has mentioned footways and walking and cycling, which sounds interesting, because usually when places develop, it's the carriageways for the cars that come first. If you're developing footways and focusing on cycling and walking, could you tell us how disabled and older people are getting on in your society, in your city society? And are they taking a bigger part? What's going on with them?
Hi, I'm Dafina. I am originally from Albania, and I work here at LSE. First of all, I want to congratulate you for the amazing job you've done for Tirana. But how would you share ideas and best practice with other mayors of other cities of Albania? Thank you.
Not only Albania, maybe. Yes. And the woman four rows up.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for your talk. I just like to ask, so if I go to Turkey or Greece, I like to see the old cities, the ruins that are left. What are you preserving of Tirana that makes Tirana, that preserves its history and its culture?
So if we take those three?
You know, what I really liked about the first question is that it's the first person who referred to this built infrastructure that most of us called sidewalk. And you never said sidewalk, you said footpaths. And I think even the word sidewalk is discriminatory. Basically means the people who walk on the side. So it's like a term coined by drivers. It's main walk and it's footpaths. And I think even in our language, we pretty much dictate design, like you very well said. Now, when it comes to working with the elderly, just like I mentioned the Urban 95 program, I invite you, actually Gil Peñalosa runs another great program, the brother of the mayor of Bogota. It's called the 880 City. And he says the endemic species are the 8-year-old and the 80-year-old. So you design also thinking of the elderly, which was not very popular, or at least not very common, for one reason, that until 50 years ago, life expectancy pretty much matched your retirement age. Now, when you retire, you're still expected to live for 40, 45 years more. It's true. So our generation, because it's a trend, you can, with vaccines and medication and medical...
Albanian food, obviously.
the Mediterranean diet. But when you understand, when you realize is that people will start to live most of their life retired than they lived in employment. And for somehow designers and urban planners completely missed this trend.
So
one thing we're doing is, just like we have these kids councils, we're founding an elderly councils. So basically to get them involved, just like we have kids in these clubs and decision-making forums, we need to have the elderly. And part of it is because we found out that after kids, it's been the elderly who's embraced this change. Because someone who's retired doesn't have any grudges, doesn't have anything to square on. So a lot of the political differences, a lot of the mean-spirited debates, when you're in that stage of your life, you're done with that. So you tend to be positive, you tend to embrace change, and you tend to think of the world that you will leave to your grandchildren. So first thing is involve them in decision-making. Second is now the new designs we're doing for a lot of these playgrounds, again, pushed by Gil mostly, and this idea is we're not calling them anymore children's playgrounds, we're more calling them generation, 880 playgrounds, where grandparents, so we're designing one in the heart of the city, Park Urinia, where we have just as many slides and water puddles as we have domino tables, card tables, chess, dame, whatever they call it,
sikon, just dame. Linking this point with
and I think mixing design between generations has been extremely important.
I mean, in the end, legislation matters here, right? You have to have it enshrined in a way, in a requirement. Can you legislate as to how the pavement, I'm not going to say sidewalk, is designed? And is that within your powers or is that a national?
No, it is. In the city, we pretty much decide in the council. So one thing we've decided for when it comes to the ramps, we just purchased our new sound systems for people who cannot see or the hearing aid. We have now in the downtown area, that's where you start. You sort of have to give an island of excellence and then you expand the ribbed tiles where you can use the white stick. So it's become much better, but I think we have a long way to go. And we need to still match what we do for the elderly as what we did for children.
We'll take the second question about lessons for other places.
You mentioned is a criticism, which I agree. We spend a lot of time communicating. And I always say it's much better to be accused of communicating than not saying anything about any of the events. And what we find out that if you're the capital, so if you're London, if you're Tirana, if you're Paris, you of course have more of a spotlight. And you operate like a rock in a puddle. You cause a ripple effect that initially starts at imitation, and then people get creative on their own context. But I found out, you know, with the new mayors, you know, it's the same color code that Tirana paves their the white stripes. Right? You know, we do sort of white and red. And when it comes to playgrounds, it's sort of a copy-paste on design. I think there's... Mayors of capitals have a fantastic opportunity to have a bigger stage and much brighter spotlight that can easily impact other cities. And, you know, this is the first time in this UN General Assembly next week in New York where for the first time the agenda of cities used to be a collection of nations, states, and now more and more people are finding out that the bucket stops with the mayor. You can have all ministers sign COP21 in Paris and in Casablanca, blah, 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 but in the end of the day, it's got the mayor who's going to plant the trees because the minister will probably be changed at the next reshuffling of the government. So I think it's important not only cities sharing experience with each other, but large national international bodies putting the cities at the epicenter.
I want to come back to this point with Amnica, but the third question, do you want?
This was about, remind me again, oh, the preserving, yeah. Now, the jury is out, right? And I think there's an institutional way that categorizes what is a national monument and what category of monument it is. So I think in the bazaar, in that intervention, now of course we did sort of the Scandinavian type roofing for the fruit market, but we also preserved the fascist buildings and the old Ottoman and typical Tirana houses in the bazaar. Now that we're becoming a bit better off, we're finding out that it's much easier for us to expropriate and buy and have them on our property title. A lot of the old houses and characteristic houses, like you'd call Victorian places in the city, rather than leave them to the private, who, you know, after so many years of decay, it's very expensive to maintain. For example, in one house that we're about to buy, Sarayet, you know, in the center of Tirana, which is an old iconic house that we will expropriate, it's much easier to do that than get 18 family branches to agree on, you know, revamping the roof or fixing it and restoring it properly. So, that's what I'm saying. So first we buy them, so we own them, then we can interfere, because otherwise the private says, no, I won't allow you. So we do expropriation for unique buildings that we believe the private owners are either way too many to agree or can't afford. So it's much better to give them money in the bank and then the city takes over and then we have a restoration unit that does this.
As I come to conclude, because we're reaching 8 o'clock, I just want to say, if we take the second of these three questions, Amaka, and I just come to you, in terms of lessons learned, we've sat here and heard this, you know, very passionate talk, which has actually delivered stuff on the ground, right? I mean, I know you have another 500 slides to show more of them. What can we learn? What do you learn? You're sitting here, you know, we in Britain tend to grind our teeth. At least two people who are sitting here in London have done things. They've lit the bridges, they've changed the pavements, but it's slow, it's hard, it's difficult. You need politicians to back you and find a way. What do you learn from this? What can we take away? What's your summary?
One of the reasons I was looking like I was going to interrupt you is actually because I had a question which I guess is continuous with that and picks up with your point and also with Adrian's, which is that I think there is a bit of a like fever for like feeling like mayors are kind of magical at the moment. And it's really easy, I think, listening to just kind of feel like you must have a magic wand somewhere that you haven't told us about how it works, you know. And I think it's like so important, this idea of like creating the story that change is possible and it can happen fast. But I guess I was really interested in pushing you a little bit more to just hear a bit more about, I guess, maybe some of the challenges and the big fights, because I think actually it's usually in them and how you resolve, like, not the quick like public opinion turnaround on the Car Free Day, but these deeper infrastructural slownesses and grindingness which make enacting these things really hard. Because I think often in them, like, those are the things that we can say we can transfer to London or to Cairo or to wherever. Because that's the kind of, you know, it's this interaction between things that move so fast on the top and the things that grind so slowly underneath.
You can do that in a minute and a half.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, look.
Just touch on the three or four headlines.
Yeah.
The things, the challenges. Where do you get stuck?
It's not a bed of roses, and you know, mayors don't have a magical wand. But I mentioned yesterday in another talk, mayors are like bikers. They take quick turns and are very agile. Central governments tend to be like 18-wheelers or like oil tankers. You know, when they make a turn, it takes forever and it's very, very, very slow. So
concrete, what didn't work?
So, for example, you know, to deal with expropriation, which is central government stuff, you know, it really takes forever. Sometimes I joke, it takes 2 weeks for one piece of paper to cross. So the bureaucracy of central government, because it's so loaded with politics, a bit like parliament here, you know?
Yeah.
And I think to get state institutions to have the same agility is a huge challenge. When it comes to dealing with, you know, one thing I forgot to mention, someone said, you know, Mr. Mayor, after your first mandate, what is the most difficult infrastructure project you did in the city? And I said, it's 10 centimeters long. And I said, no, it's the space from here to here. Because that is the most difficult thing to change. So one of the reasons we have double shifts in the schools, that's why we're in this school building spree, most inspired from Medellin and Mayor Fajardo, building these iconic schools in the poorest areas, mostly occupied by the narcos and Pablo Escobar. And his argument was, if we build schools that look like amazing cathedrals, that look like St. Paul, in the poorest area, that becomes the social cathedral for that community. But it's not enough to build a school, because we get grandparents who say, oh, no, no, but the traditional school is that one on the other side of the city. So here, again, is this 10 centimeters. This was the biggest debate this last week. When we said, I said, look, you're being bussed 1 hour, bussed back 1 hour for 300 days a year. So I had this discussion with parents, a sort of open TV intervention. We said, 300 days times 2 hours a day, 600 hours. In 600 hours, you can learn Chinese. In 600 hours, you can play an instrument. In 600 hours, you can become a great soccer player. So just to get people to match mental infrastructure with the physical infrastructure is a huge, huge challenge.
Amika, last words to you.
It sounds like to me, to respond to your question from the way that you answered it, that in a sense it's a question about scale, right? It's like how you can make infrastructures that put people who can be dynamic and can do the fast turn of the bike over areas that are, I guess, containable enough or understandable enough that that's viable, right? Because as you say, when you scale out to the national, it becomes a different
trickier
story.
Yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, in London that would be borough mayors, right?
Maybe the one concept to take away from this exchange is the need for agility. I mean, agility both at the level of how you navigate the different institutions, but also creating agile environments. I think that's one of the causes of too much determination of what actually happens to the environment, that it's too fixed with one ideology of what it was about. I think you all realize we could go on for another 2 hours, but we won't. But I think we all know that it's worth being infected by the enthusiasm and the passion of how to change cities. Thanks very much to Ariel.